and welcome to We Are History, the laughable attempt at a history.
The what attempt, John?
The laughable attempt.
The laughable
attempt at a history podcast with me and Dame Angela Barnes.
Hello, hello.
Angela.
Oh, well, you're Lord John O'Farrell, aren't you?
Lord O'Farrell of Clapham. Yeah.
Of Sealand, surely.
That's right. Yes, I. For those people who haven't heard the Sealand episode, go back and listen to it. And I'm a genuine Lord of Sealand because Angela paid the 40 quid or whatever it is. Maybe it wasn't that much. I don't know. But she paid to have me made a member of the nobility of an old platform in the North Sea.
Indeed. It was in lieu of your disappearing Christmas present.
So. Oh, yes, that's true. Oh, well, look. Angela, you can't see me, I understand, on this Zoom call.
I can't. I feel like such a great... I don't even know how I've done this, John, but on my... So usually, for the listeners, we record this on GarageBand.
Yeah.
And we have Zoom open as well, so we can chat on Zoom. But I've opened Zoom, and I've lost it.
You can't see my smiling face.
So I can't see your lovely smiling face.
All those impressive books I've lined up behind me have no worth whatsoever.
Absolutely pointless.
Impressive looking history tomes.
But the thing is, you can see me and I can't see you, and I have to remember that while we record this. Yeah, I'm a bit worried.
You,
I'm just going to
not pick your nose,
nose
like that
or something.
don't wipe it there. This might be another one you parents can use for your homeschooling,
yes,
for the
indeed.
National curriculum. We're making an effort here. We're trying to do things that, you know, make things a little bit easier for kids and their parents at home during this difficult time. Angela, we are doing the interregnum.
We are. So if you don't know what the interregnum is, it's the bit in between Charles I getting his head chopped off and the restoration of the monarchy with Charles II.
So when Britain was a republic, it's probably a sexier title.
A republic. We had a little play for about 11 years in the middle of the 17th century. We had a little go at being a republic. Now, I've never really learnt much about this period at school or anything. It's sort of the English Civil Wars happened, and we'll come on to English Civil Wars in a minute.
Yeah, oh God, we're going to have a bloody 4-hour introduction from Angela about this.
And then the Restoration happened, and all I really knew was there was a bit in between where Christmas was banned, and that was it. So I thought we'd have a little look at it and what actually happened, and
it's a big deal, isn't it? It's a big deal to do away with the monarchy for 11 years. I mean, the French make a massive deal about chopping the heads off their kings.
Oh, they never stop banging on about their
republic.
We
were doing that 150 years before them.
Exactly, mate.
We invented
it. So I thought we'd have a little look at it. All right, John, calm down.
We invented it. They go and do it better than we do. That's what I'm saying.
There's lots of different sort of perspectives as to how much of a role the Republic really played in the sort of constitutional monarchy that we have today, because there's lots of different interpretations, and later on came lots of different sort of revisionist interpretations. You've got a Marxist interpretation of what happened. You've got a sort of more traditional Whiggish sort of interpretation of what happened. So I thought, well, we'll talk about it. We'll talk about what happened, and then we'll sort of see at the end. Because Oliver Cromwell, again, is a name... You know, I think all I really remember learning at school was he was a roundhead and won the English Civil War. That's what we learned without really knowing what any of that meant. And obviously, John, your heritage being slightly Irish.
Slightly Irish? I am Irish.
John, you grew up in Maidenhead.
In the Irish quarter of Maidenhead. Oh, the wearing of the green. I'm as
a
Irish.
Lovely little dance, John. I wish I could see it.
I'm Irish as cricket itself.
So with that in mind, John probably has a slightly, well, not necessarily a different view of Oliver Cromwell to me, but he probably had, through your family history, a different sort of
He's a
narrative.
Baddie. He's a baddie, as far as the Irish are concerned. Whereas in England, there he is outside of the House of Parliament. He's got pride of place, great big statue of Oliver Cromwell. Ian Paisley, the Reverend Ian Paisley, would always doff his cap to Cromwell as he went past. That tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're feeling like toppling any more statues, Oliver Cromwell outside Parliament, feel free. Say that We Are History Pod gave you permission.
Say John O'Farrell sent you.
John O'Farrell said it's okay. Yeah, he's a psychopath, Britain's own Ayatollah Khomeini, really, a religious zealot who murdered in the name of his faith and massacred millions in Drogheda and Wexford. But we'll get on to that.
We'll get onto that. I must admit, I had a flick through one of your history books, John. Your
best source,
the Utterly Impartial History of
Britain. Yes.
And I thought I'll have a look at what you've written in this chapter on Oliver Cromwell. And yeah, you do refer to him as England's Ayatollah Khomeini, which, you know,
he was.
You weren't ambivalent. Let's put it that way. about your feelings towards Mr. Cromwell. Yeah. Well, let's start at the beginning.
Oh, here we go.
But we won't go back that far. We'll go back. We've got Charles I on the throne. So we're in the 1600s, early, yeah. Well, sort of 1625, I think he came to the throne. And he wasn't massively liked. He wasn't the stablest of monarchs. Yeah. He was 5 foot something with a stammer.
The shortest ever English monarch.
Is that true?
And even shorter when they chopped his head off.
What's really important, I think, to remember when we're talking about this time is that you can't separate God from the state in the way that we might now. You know, so the government was religion. It was part of...
The reason the king was there, divine right of kings. Yeah.
Exactly. So...
Do we need to explain what divine right of kings is to our listeners in certain parts of the country?
Do you want to?
Oh, well, it's the idea that there's a direct line from God to the monarch who is put there by the Almighty to rule on his behalf. And, you know, if you are the monarch, it's quite an attractive thing to put about, saying, well, I am God's representative on earth.
And what are you going to do about
it? Yeah, exactly. You can't argue with me because God sent me and instructed me to rule over you.
So exactly.
So that's what they believed in.
Yeah, so we are a sort of a century earlier. We've had Henry VIII split with Rome, which essentially started the English Reformation, making England a Protestant country.
Eventually,
So you've got Protestants in England, you've got Presbyterians in Scotland. Now, the English Reformation, there was a lot of people who felt the English Reformation didn't go quite far enough.
No.
And that the Anglican Church was still a bit too Catholic-y.
Yeah.
For their liking. It was still a bit too much pomp and regalia. Yeah. And
they got rid of the little Virgin Marys with the little hearts that lit up in the inside. like you get at Knock Airport. But it's still, I mean, you know, lots of churchmen today would say the Anglican Church is a Catholic church.
Yeah, particularly like High Anglican is very...
Yeah. Whereas, you know, at this point, we've got the Puritans coming along, haven't we? So it starts to get much more anti-Catholic.
Absolutely. So the Puritans were a sort of extreme Protestant faction. And at the time, they didn't refer to themselves as Puritans at the time. It was actually a pejorative term.
Yep.
And the word Puritan was sort of a synonym for the word stickler.
Okay.
You know, like somebody really... And they referred to themselves, John, as godly or saints.
Okay.
Or God's children.
Blimey.
So, you know, they had lofty ideals.
They were picking themselves up a bit, weren't they?
Just a tad.
It's like making yourself a Lord of Sealand or something.
Now, the problem was we have Charles I on the throne and he, while ostensibly Anglican, he's married to a French Catholic wife, Henrietta Maria of France. And so he's sympathetic to the Catholics. Yeah. Now, like I say, he wasn't the stablest of monarchs and there were constant arguments with his parliament, which actually led him to lock out members of parliament for 11 years from 1629 to 1640. They called it the 11 years tyranny. Right. Charles I basically did what he darn well pleased.
Right, that's interesting. Now, if a little aside here, at about this time, I think, was the last time that the French monarch had his parliament. I think that was about 1615 or something. And they didn't call parliament again until 1789. So they really let those frustrations boil up. We had them boiling up for 11 years and we had a little civil war. The French left it for 150 years and look what happened over there. So maybe that's why.
Yeah. But it's, maybe that's why our revolution was a bit...
Bit half-hearted and a bit English, if you're honest.
Yeah,
it was
absolutely.
Like, we tried it. We didn't like
it
very
much.
We had
to go, but it was all just a bit
We'd
too
seen
much.
The brochures and republicanism wasn't for us.
Well, I'd rather a cup of tea. And, you know, the thing about the Brits. Well, not the Brits, the English, let's face it. The thing about the English is, let's not rock the boat, isn't it?
Yeah. Don't make a fuss,
small
dear.
Small C conservative. Don't make a fuss. Let's just keep things as they are, and I'm sure it'll all be fine. Anyway, Charles I has done quite a lot of things to piss people off during this time. Forced loans, ship money, which is a non-parliamentary tax that he could just levy as he felt like it to raise money for warships and so on, which is very much seen as illegal by parliamentarians.
Yes.
And in 1637, Charles tries to impose a new prayer book on the Scots. Now, the Scots are Presbyterian.
Right.
When I was growing up, in a completely atheist family.
Yes.
So I was never christened or anything.
No.
I knew because of the news and the troubles in Northern Ireland, there were Protestants and Catholics.
Yes.
But then, you know, the sort of subdivisions
among
particularly the Protestants starts getting really confusing.
It's worse than the Labour Party, I tell you.
It is. It really is.
Yeah, the sects just keep on dividing and dividing. Those divisions, actually, you mentioned Northern Ireland, they sort of were... sort of come from this period, really. They come from Cromwell's campaigns and, well, the plantations were before.
Elizabeth I's time, Ulster Scots were sort of sent over to create, basically to displace Catholics from their land.
But that really got going during this period. But I must let you continue. Atheist.
So the Scots aren't too happy about this and they start to rebel against it, and they invaded and took Newcastle and Durham because they didn't want this new prayer book inflicted on them, which had a more high church service, a more Anglican church service in it.
So they said, let's take the posh universities.
So let's take the Oxbridge rejects. And so he's made this unilateral decision to go to war, but he's got no money. So after this 11 years of no parliament, he decides to recall parliament because he needs some money for this war.
Yeah, big mistake.
Big mistake, because at the same time, there's a Catholic uprising in Ireland. Right. And Parliament, they knew they needed to raise an army to deal with the uprising in Ireland.
Yes.
And they were a bit worried that Charles could then use that army against them.
Yes.
So the Parliament at this time passed a bill for the army and navy to be controlled by Parliament, not by the king.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
That is a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. And these demands of Parliament really sort of clash with Charles' whole divine right of kings thing that he was really into. You know, that had served him well. But in Parliament, this move was passed by 11 votes, only by 11 votes. So it's close. So there were royalists in Parliament and Charles felt that he had their support. So although the bill was passed, he felt like it wasn't a complete defeat. So he rides into Parliament. With 400 soldiers to try and arrest 5 MPs, including the Puritan John Pym, who's the most important one.
Can I interject there, Angela? John Pym was
the
direct ancestor of Francis Pym, who is a minister in Thatcher's government. So Thatcher's minister for, I think he was Foreign Affairs or I can't remember. Mm. But anyway, he was a direct descendant of this John Pym. So shows you, it all stays in the family. And the reason that we have all that palaver at the state opening of Parliament of Black Rod banging on the door of the Commons is because the monarch isn't allowed into the Commons. And Black Rod is the Queen's representative in Westminster. And this all stems from Charles going down there with an army and trying to get into Parliament where the monarch is no longer allowed in the Commons.
Because MPs are supposed to be safe from arrest in the chamber. The king can't just walk into the chamber and arrest a load of MPs. Now, these MPs that he wanted to arrest had actually been warned that he was coming. So they'd fled. They weren't there. So now he's in Parliament with 400 soldiers. And it's a bit obvious what he's come to do. He can't really be like,
I've just come to borrow your printer.
Exactly.
Mine's run out of ink.
So citizens are pissed off now.
Quite interesting that the citizens sort of take it upon themselves to be offended on behalf of Parliament.
Very much so. And they take up arms and they surround Parliament. And this is the riots and whatever that ensue is the beginning of the first English Civil War.
Right.
Now, a note here, John, that the English Civil War very much wasn't English.
It wasn't very civil either. If I'm honest,
it wasn't very civil either. But to call it the English Civil War is a bit of a misnomer, because quite a lot happened in Scotland and Ireland because Charles I was the king of England, Scotland, and Ireland.
Yes,
I think historians now prefer to call it the War of Three Kingdoms. Yeah, so maybe that's what we'll try and remember to call it that.
That's not like this. Don't like that title, Angela. We'll have to come up with something.
Something a bit snappier,
yeah, like Cromwell's Wars or something. I don't know.
Cromwell's Wars. Cromwell's Failures, that's Cromwell's, what we'll call it. Right. Yeah. So the Navy declared itself for the parliamentarians. Wow. So that was a pretty big deal as well. And there were royalist areas. So Oxford, for example, was a very royalist area. Of course it was.
Yeah.
East Anglia was very parliamentarian. In fact, that's where Oliver Cromwell was a commander in East Anglia.
He's an MP from Cambridgeshire, wasn't he? Yeah.
For Cambridge,
I mean, it's weird there because you've got, a lot of the commerce would have been along the rivers. So the River Severn had Gloucester and Worcester in opposite hands. So you couldn't travel up and down those on either side. Oxford was royalist. Reading was parliamentarian. So you couldn't travel up and down the Thames with cargo for either side. So it made the whole thing very difficult.
It was a mess.
It was
a bit of a mess because there wasn't, a north-south divide it was factions all over the place.
Yes.
Which made it very difficult to sort of draw up battle lines, I guess.
Yes.
And also the support in different areas would change depending on who's controlling them.
Yeah.
Because once either the parliamentarians or the royalists controlled an area, that area then gets plundered for resources.
Yep.
They raise taxes for capital and the people go, hang on a minute, we were on your side.
Yes.
So allegiances changed and the whole thing. It was also a bit of an excuse for the sort of clans in Scotland and in Ireland to dig up old clan rivalries as well. So it wasn't, just a series of battles between
two massive armies.
And these massive armies. There was lots of little skirmishes and battles going on all over the place. Just to be clear, what we're talking about, the royalists were obviously, they were the cavaliers, called cavaliers, John, because they rode on horseback, not because they just had a cavalier attitude.
I thought maybe they drove a cavalier.
Maybe a Vauxhall cavalier. My mum had one of them.
It comes from, so cavalier actually means on horse, doesn't it? Like chevalier.
Yeah, chevalier.
Yeah, yeah.
And the parliamentarians were the roundheads.
Why were they called that?
They had roundheads, John, presumably.
I suppose so, because everyone else had squareheads. It's quite easy to tell them apart, the squareheads and the roundheads, I suppose. No, I think it's something to do with the haircuts of the apprentices in London who supported them. I think they had
is that right? Yeah. Like basin cuts.
Yeah, I think they had something like that. And so that mob who surrounded
Parliament. Was it not the helmets?
You would have thought the helmets makes more sense, but I've got a feeling it's something to do with the haircuts. Somebody might be able to put us straight on that. But the cavaliers had big girly locks, didn't they? And feathery hats.
Yeah,
and the roundheads were all like...
They were sort of foppish looking, the cavaliers.
They were like the new romantics.
Very new romantic. I was just going to say.
So it's basically skinheads versus new romantics. You can see who's going to win this one, really. Well, it's Sham 69 versus Boy George. It's no contest. Jimmy Percy is going to kill him.
So these battles are happening all over the place, which we can be thankful for now, John, because without those battles, we wouldn't have the Sealed Knot Reenactment Society reenacting them every weekend, and they'd be on the streets, John. So,
No real ale tent.
Do you know who the Sealed Knot were? The Sealed Knot were a secret royalist association who, during the Republic, were seeking to restore the monarchy secretly, but they were uncovered by the spymaster, John Thurlow.
Oh, there you go. Very interesting.
Little thing.
So you have done your research on this. There's you saying you read my book.
Yeah, I read some other books as well, John.
Before we got on. What have you read on this? Well, I've read your book, John, because the other ones were hard.
Yeah, they were like 600 pages, John. I've got shit to do. I did read a book called Providence Lost by Paul Lay, which is, he's the editor. I think it's History Today magazine or one of the history magazines anyway.
So are we getting to the bloody end of the Civil War?
We're getting there, John. So in 1644, there's this massive battle at Marston Moor. People have heard of that one, probably. 4,000 royalist troops died. Over 1,000 were captured and imprisoned. Now, at this point, our mate Cromwell, he's not the leader of the army.
No, he's just
doing... He is just in East Anglia doing his thing there.
Yeah.
But he does prove himself to be an excellent soldier, despite not being sort of trained as a soldier. He probably played a lot of Call of Duty or something, I don't know.
Warhammer, he's got his little model, little figures he's painting and all that. So, I mean, it should be said, you say 4,000 royalist troops died at Marston Moor. The English though, the War of Three Kingdoms, as we shall call it. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of the number of dead, it killed a greater number of the British population than the First World War, in terms of just the carnage, in terms of people dying on both sides, the massacres of Cromwell and the starvations that were sort of followed. It was a massive, massive sort of thing for Britain at the time. This wasn't just a load of sort of foppish blokes on horses dying. It really affected
the country. Oh, no, it was a lot of civilians.
Yeah.
Where are we now? So we've got
Basically Parliament wins, isn't it, really?
Parliament wins. So Cromwell is heading up his forces in his native East Anglia, this Puritan heartland. He would sing hymns, John, going into battle. That must have been a frightening scene, mustn't it? Army coming towards you.
A Christian army. I mean, that's a weird concept. They were deeply, deeply religious. So it's like, right, if you capture the enemy, you know what to do. Instant forgiveness. Instant forgiveness. Also, if they've heard the good news about Jesus and if they'd like to come to a Sunday school meeting.
Imagine these army coming over the hill singing all things bright and beautiful.
Yeah, morning has broken. We laugh, but they were zealous, and that makes a difference. You know, they were driven
fundamentalist extremists.
They were fundamentalist Christians. Yeah,
And in any religion, it's the fundamentalist extremists and the ones that you got to worry about, right?
Yeah, yeah. If I remember right, Charles hands himself over to the Scots, doesn't he? Rather than surrender to the English, he goes, "I'll go up there."
Yep. We've got the Battle of Naseby then. You've got the New Model Army by this point. Not the band from Bradford, the Parliamentarian Army.
It's a lot of music theme, isn't it?
Yeah. You've got the Battle of Naseby, and that is basically the end of the first English Civil War, War of Three Kingdoms, whatever you want to call it.
Yep.
Parliamentarians win. They find some secret letters at the Battle of Naseby that say that Charles is willing to suspend anti-Catholic laws in return for help from the Irish Catholics. So he knows that he's outnumbered in England and Scotland.
It was those emails. It was the emails.
That's right. And his wife, who's Catholic, obviously, and her son have been asking for help from abroad. She's from France. So they've been secretly sort of trying to build up a Catholic support.
Yeah.
But at this point, Charles then hands himself over to the Scots.
Right.
Now, what he tries to do while he's with the Scots is to sort of divide his enemies, divide and conquer, which he manages to do at a certain point because there is a gap growing between the politicians and parliamentarians and the New Model Army.
Well, the thing is, they keep saying, right, we've won the war, we defeat you. Now you've got to agree to that. I don't agree to it. No, come on, we won. That's not fair. We won this
Play
war.
Play fair, King.
You've
come
got
on.
To agree to it's a complete rout in all the battles. We're in charge. So you've got to give up these. No, I don't give up these things. And so they go, what do you do when the king just won't, is standing in the way of any progress?
Yeah. And they try different settlements. Like by this point, you've got Cromwell has got decisive control of the army.
Yeah.
He's crushing revolts left, right and centre, defeats the Scots at Preston. There's uprisings in Kent and Essex and Wales. The country's at war again. This is Second Civil War. And the MPs decide to try and negotiate a treaty with the king.
It's never going to work.
Treaty of Newport. It's not going to work.
Especially Newport. I mean, really,
Well, not all the MPs. I think we have to remember, not all the MPs are sort of Puritan.
No.
A lot of them have royalist sympathies and they're concerned about that there's this sort of growing radicalism within the New Model Army.
Yes.
And so they're trying to negotiate this settlement whereby the king's restored, but without the powers he had before to do what he pleased.
Absolutely.
Thomas Fairfax, who was the commander of the New Model Army, he got wind that the Parliament, who were then ruled by these Presbyterian factions, were ready to come to an agreement with the king. And so he orders a purge.
Right.
And that's where Colonel Thomas Pride... Do you remember, John?
Yeah.
When we got a bit miffed that Charles I had tried to arrest five MPs in Parliament, because you can't do that.
How many are they going to do?
Well, Cromwell's lot, in what became known as Pride's Purge, because it was Colonel Thomas Pride who instigated it, they arrested 40 MPs and evicted another 60.
This is what I'm saying, Angela. Cromwell is worse than the bloody monarchs he displaced. That's my point. He was a bigger dictator. They took greater powers than the absolute monarch. And his statue's outside the bloody House of Commons. But our listeners are gathering as we speak in Parliament Square to pull down Cromwell's statue.
So basically, he's got rid of everyone out of Parliament except for the yes men that are in this radical faction that everyone was worried about. And he forms what's known as the Rump Parliament.
No giggling at the back.
No, come on, John. So now we've, to all intents and purposes, got a bit of a military dictatorship because we've got Cromwell and the new model army has taken over Parliament, or certainly ensured Parliament is filled with his.
Yeah, it should be said here that Cromwell was in power because he was a brilliant military general. He could read a battlefield and he could win a battle, but he was not. You know, Napoleon was a brilliant general and a brilliant sort of politician and leader and delegator and appointer of men. Cromwell did not have any of those skills. He was not a man who thought, oh, this person will be good for running the Navy. This person. He basically chose people on how often they prayed in a day. I'm not joking.
He filled the Parliament up with the godliest people as he saw them, basically.
So now it would have been Cliff Richard at Defence. It would have been Mary Whitehouse as Minister for Sport. It would have been all the people, all the people presenting Stars on Sundays would have been, the Exchequer and in the Foreign Office.
Yeah, Alan Jones.
Alan Jones would have been there. He would have been like Schools Minister.
So while the King's still alive and he's still got sympathisers, this is a problem for Cromwell. So he can see only one way out. That way out is to put Charles I, the King, on trial.
Oh no!
So
what's he up for?
He's up for treason, blood and mischief.
Oh, I would have let him off the mischief, Angela, if I'm honest.
It doesn't feel like mischief should come at the end of that, does it? Yeah. Treason, blood. It's like saying someone was put on trial for genocide and shoplifting.
You have been found guilty of the massacre of Drogheda, plus you're taking the Wi-Fi of the person from the house next door.
Exactly. So maybe don't worry so much about that one. Now, some people, John, might say that the court that was amassed to try Charles I, they might say it wasn't wholly legit.
It was a kangaroo court, Angela.
I mean, sure, there wasn't a judge, John, and no defence witnesses were allowed. But, I mean, they just clogged the place up.
They do. They get in the way.
Charles obviously refused to recognise the authority of the court. He declined to plead.
They always do that, don't they? I do not recognise the authority of this court. Everyone, it's like Ceausescu did it, didn't
he? Ceausescu said the same thing.
They always say the same thing. It's like, I do not recognise.
Didn't stop him getting shot in the head, though, did
he? You recognise me. I was there this morning. I was the one bringing you tea.
Yeah, into exactly. cell.
So this kangaroo court, why wasn't it called a kangaroo court, Angela?
Because we hadn't been to Australia yet, John.
Very good. Very good. Yes. In fact, the Dutch explorer, Tasman.
Tasmania.
He would just sailed along the north coast of Australia around this time, but the postcards hadn't come back yet. But right, no,
so
it was a
kangaroo. Hadn't seen a kangaroo yet.
You hadn't seen a kangaroo, but they still were going, it's a kangaroo court. This is a kangaroo court.
Charles declined to plead.
Yep.
Despite being asked 43 times.
Oh, God.
That's like a Paxman level.
Oh, it is, isn't it? Yes. Did you threaten to undermine him?
Yeah. So Charles I, as we know, was sentenced to death by, and I quote, severing of head from body.
That would do it.
Should do the job. This was actually the first time a monarch had ever been lawfully killed. Now, it's not to say monarchs hadn't been killed before. I always think of Edward II.
You go straight for the most gruesome one, don't you?
Straight for red hot poker up the arse. Right. Straight for that one.
Then you've got Richard III, a king from a horse. He was killed at Bosworth Field. Edward V, the prince in the tower.
Yep.
As played in schools and colleges television by yours truly in 1975.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
I love it.
But this is the first time a court, a sort of quasi-court, said, we're having him. Yeah.
That's right. So on the 30th of January, 1649, Charles I was put to death. When he was brought out they erected a scaffold outside the banqueting hall in Whitehall.
Okay.
And he wore two vests, John.
Right.
Because it was a cold day and he didn't want to be seen shivering because he thought the crowd might think it was him quivering with fear.
Wow. The crowd gathers because there's not much going on at that time.
No telly, John, no Netflix.
There's no Netflix, no telly. So King being executed, that's quite a surprise.
Yeah.
But they were not in the mood for this particularly, were they? Cromwell had not caught the public mood particularly.
No, he thought, I think because of the parliamentarian victories across the country, he felt that he had the will of the people. Oh, that phrase.
Yes.
But actually, when the king was beheaded, the crowd groaned and they wept.
Oh.
And he went, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that.
So what did he do? Did he do anything to make it
better?
Well,
usually what happened after a beheading is you get your head whacked on a spike and put at traitor's gate.
Yes.
But they didn't do that with Charles I. He decided to allow it to be sewn back on.
Oh, okay.
Which does feel Did that work? Little like shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, John.
Did it make him better?
I mean, I can't be sure, but...
Yeah, I mean, surgery was very primitive back then, wasn't it? So it's probably not going to work. Yeah, but we've sewn it on now. What are you upset about? We put it back.
Yeah, come on. It's what you wanted.
We've accepted our mistake.
Stop crying. Jeez.
So suddenly, we're not a monarchy anymore.
Nope. Britain's now essentially a republic run by an army of hardcore Protestants who are determined, John, to take the fun out of fundamentalism.
Oh, I like what you did there.
Did you see what I did there?
That might be... I might need a break just to recover from that pun.
We'll take a short break. Because I'm going to have a quick leaf through the Old Testament and you're going to hide your rosaries.
See you in a minute. Welcome back to part two of We Are History. Angela's job was to do the research for a podcast on Cromwell's rule. We're halfway through. We haven't bloody got there yet, Angela.
I like to contextualise things, otherwise it doesn't mean anything, does it? And also, as we previously said, not much been written about the actual protectorate.
Yeah. So we've got there now, though, so that's good.
We're now in
1649. The king is dead. Now we have the Commonwealth of England. Is that like with the Commonwealth Games and everything?
Exactly, John. That's exactly what it is.
Not good enough to win the Olympics, but...
We should probably at this point say something about Wales, because it's not that Wales wasn't there, it's just that it wasn't a country.
Right, it was like England and Wales had the same laws,
Scotland,
generally.
Yeah. Technically, it was the Kingdom of England, Ireland and Scotland, wasn't it?
Right, okay, because it's a principality,
but
Wales.
But the king's dead now, so it's not a kingdom. It's now the Commonwealth of England.
Yes, hey, with sort of Cromwell sort of notionally in charge, or...?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's a military dictatorship at this point. So we'll come on to what happens next in a minute. But at the moment, it's, it's... certainly a military which is led by Cromwell.
Yes.
Is in charge.
And is it Cromwell... is it a jolly place? Is it like, you guys do what you want. Let's just have some fun. We've had a horrible old war. Well, let's have a festival of Brexit.
It wasn't that fun, John, but it's about to get a lot less fun few years. But in this period, Cromwell wasn't in England very much because he was busy in other parts of the kingdom.
Oh, here we go. This is my people.
Is your people.
That's a terrible, terrible thing.
Indeed. As we know, since Elizabethan times, these plantations were
going back to
made
Elizabeth
in Ireland to displace the Catholics, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There are several Catholic uprisings all during this period. Like we said, you know, amongst the skirmishes of the Wars of the Three Kingdoms were Catholic uprisings.
Yes, 1641, there were significant Catholic uprisings, thousands of Protestants killed. And those uprisings, atrocities against the Protestants were greatly exaggerated and circulated in England. So Cromwell would have gone there with a great sense of vengeance anyway. And a sense
absolutely.
Of
absolutely. Yeah. And also, I mean, the Catholics were kind of loyal to the king, they knew that the king had loyalist sympathies, so they were prepared to be more on his side.
Yeah.
However, what I think we have to remember as well is that to the Puritans, Catholics, it wasn't just that they were a different sort of Christian. They were the actual embodiment of the Antichrist.
Absolutely.
To Puritans. And they were, to Puritans, subhuman.
Yeah.
And in the 1930s in Europe, when, you know, the rise of Hitler and Mussolini and so on, they were often compared to Cromwell at that time in the 1930s.
Right.
And people thought it was unfair. But actually... What was happening with the Catholics was exactly what was happening with the Jews, in that by making them somehow not human, this is how people were able to carry out these atrocities because they weren't,
If I could quote...
That's how they were seen.
If I could quote a bit Cromwell here this time, he's telling the Catholic clergy, "Your covenant is with death and hell. You are part of the Antichrist, whose kingdom the scripture so expressly speaks should be laid in blood, yea, in the blood of the saints. Ere it be long, you must all have blood to drink, even the dregs of the cup of the fury and wrath of God, which will be poured out unto you." So that was...
So he's pretty sure what he thinks.
Yeah, anger management course. You know, he was with his therapist, he was letting it all out, I think, there. But yeah.
So Cromwell obviously threatened by the Catholics.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind as well, you know, Spain is the great enemy at this point and a great power in Europe.
And
is Catholic. Similarly, France
is
a Catholic superpower at the moment. So the Catholics represented everything that was anti-English to Cromwell. So he goes to Ireland and commits incredible atrocities that we are not taught about. But
no.
I know, obviously, Irish people are very much aware of.
Yeah, the massacres at Drogheda, he didn't just kill the soldiers. He went and killed all the women and children. And it was babies on pitchforks time, really. It was.
I mean, there was the siege of Drogheda took place from the 3rd to the 11th of September 1649. And during that time, they women and children taking refuge in churches. The churches were burnt to the ground with the women and children in them. Commander of the town's forces was beaten to death with his own wooden leg.
Yes.
He ordered that all Irish children should be sent to the West Indies to work as slave labourers in sugar plantations. I mean, that's something we're not taught for sure.
If you go to Montserrat today, they still have an Irish stamp on the passport. And they still drink Guinness and they still celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Even though most people there are black, it's got a strong Irish heritage because Cromwell sent them all over there in the 1650s.
Yeah. And he committed atrocities all over Ireland, mostly in Drogheda and in Wexford.
Yes.
He did similar things there. He knew that these children being sent as slave labourers, he knew they'd die. Many of them would die. But in his mind, dead children couldn't grow into Catholic adults and have more children.
They were agents of Satan in his head, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, sent to Barbados sounds quite nice at the moment, but take our word for it.
It's different in the 17th century.
It's not as nice as it sounds.
No. So it is completely understandable why the Irish not fans of Oliver Cromwell.
No.
Meanwhile, he's in Ireland doing his Irish conquest campaign.
Yep.
And in Scotland, they've accepted Charles II, who is the son of Charles I.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's a clue.
They've accepted him. There's a slight clue. They've accepted him as the king.
Yeah.
So they've crowned him, basically, and said, you are now the king.
He was crowned at Scone.
Yes.
Or is it Scone? Hey!
Yay!
If we could high five over Zoom, we would.
Oh, what? Proud of that.
We're on fire tonight.
So he begins recruiting an army in Scotland to support his cause. I love the fact that the army was led by someone called David Leslie. I mean, it just sounds like an accountant, doesn't it?
Blue Peter presenter.
David Leslie and Sons.
So then we have more battles, don't we?
More battles. So Cromwell comes back and here's what's happening in Scotland. So him and the New Model Army, not the Bradford Band, they head to Scotland. And despite, obviously, he would have had some losses of his army. The army's so strong and so massive.
And he's such a good general.
Such a good general. He takes 16,000 men and they defeat the Scots in the Battle of Dunbar.
Yep.
Charles II isn't dissuaded at this point. He goes into hiding, I think, in Stirling or somewhere.
Right.
And then he comes out and he marches to Worcester.
He comes
quite far.
Yeah.
And then they have the final Battle of Worcester. Now, Charles II has marched 16,000 men to Worcester, but Cromwell's got 28,000 men.
Plus he's a better general.
He's a better general. And he, of course, defeats the royalists at Worcester.
What does Charles do? They must be looking for him everywhere.
He manages to get away.
No. He hides up a tree, Angela. He hides up an oak tree.
Oh, I missed the bit where he hides up the tree.
He hides up the royal oak. He goes up an oak tree and they're searching from everywhere. And they go, come on, we give up. I'm not falling for that.
Come out wherever you are.
And then they rename all the pubs. And why do they have to give it a silly name like the Royal Oak? It's the Slug and Lettuce was perfectly fine. And they start renaming them the Royal Oak. So, yeah, that's where we get all our Royal Oak pubs from. And the myth of that. Well, it's true. It's not a myth. He did hide up an oak tree, which is a very sort of English symbolic sort of thing, really, isn't it?
Mm.
So then he flees. Then he flees to France.
Yep. And around 8,000 Scottish soldiers are captured and imprisoned, and they were then deported to New England, Bermuda, and West Indies to work as indentured labourers. So he's had these massive successes in his campaign.
Military
successes. He's sorted out the Catholics in Ireland. He's sorted out the Royalists in Scotland. And the Puritans very much see this as they believe that they are God's children.
Yep.
And they believe that they have divine providence to carry out that they are doing the work of God, right? That right. Their mission is God-given.
Yep.
And these successes, the fact that they're defeating any sort of dissenters, to their minds, means that they're doing the right thing.
Yes.
They feel like they're the vanguard of the New Jerusalem. They're God's children. There's
not a lot of doubt in their minds, was there? There wasn't
not a lot
they
of
were
doubt.
Like, I wonder if I'm doing the right thing here. What do you think? There's not much of that, was there, with these zealots?
No. Now, during the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, before Charles I was beheaded, there were several radical factions that were part of the New Model Army that were fighting the tyranny of the king.
Yep.
You had the Levellers.
Another great band.
Crusty. Yeah. Lots of musicians came out this time.
Yeah.
The Levellers sort of believed in a more fair society. I read one book, it said Levellers believed in complete equality, but only for men, obviously.
Well,
like, let's not go mad.
Yes. But to their credit, they did argue. They did argue for the lowering of the price of beer, which is which I think we should all get behind.
We can all get behind that.
Yeah.
Of course, John, we had the same problem, didn't we, with these radical factions as the left have in this country today, to this day.
So
you had the Levellers and you had the Diggers.
Yeah, the Diggers.
Well, the Diggers were sort of the communist.
Yeah, they were the Judean People's Front. They were the People's Front of Judea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you had these sort of rival radical factions.
Yes.
Happening now. As the defeats in Ireland and Scotland happened, the Levellers and the more radical factions start to distance themselves.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to get what they want from a landowner like Cromwell.
Cromwell was, I think it's easy to think of Cromwell as being a radical when he absolutely wasn't.
No.
He was a landowner. He acted in the interest of other landowners.
Yeah.
He wasn't really even anti-monarchy, and we'll come on to that a bit more in a bit. But
I think chopping his head off is a bit anti-monarchy, Angela. I mean, I'm not going to be a pedant. Call me a pedant, but I'd say, he sewed his head back on again, but it still have him down.
He was anti-John. A monarch.
Oh,
I'll grant you that.
Okay.
Within Parliament, you still had a sort of mix of these slightly more radical factions. You had some royalists still in Parliament. And the divide between Oliver Cromwell's army and the rest of Parliament was getting bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of this growing gap, Cromwell... He went into Parliament and he said, "You have sat too long for any good you've been doing lately. In the name of God, go."
Okay.
Can we not do something like that?
That would be
today?
Good. Yeah, that would be useful. In fact, I think that was quoted back at Chamberlain in 1939, wasn't it? In the name of God, go. I think that was revived. One of the Parliament's greatest hits. But yeah, so did he do? Did he kick them all out?
He kicks out the rump part. The Parliament that was already sort of made of his yes men.
Yeah.
But he kicks them out, and then he has the Barebone Parliament, as it was known, or the Assembly of Saints.
Bloody hell.
Again,
you
know, they were quite up themselves. And this Assembly of Saints became a bit of a subject of popular ridicule because it was just the godliest men. It was the 140 godliest men he could find.
The 140 bigots, they were called in one of the books I read. Yeah,
religious bigots. And their task was to try and devise a constitution that would reflect the gospel values and teach people the responsibilities of freedom and blah, blah, blah.
They did write a constitution. It's the only time this country's had a written constitution was the one
they
drew
didn't.
Up.
John Lambert did, didn't he?
Okay, right.
After 5 months, they surrendered power back to Cromwell because they couldn't come up with a constitution. And his army colleagues asked him to take power as a constitutional monarch at that point. And that's when John Lambert, who was a major general, he wrote the Instrument of Government, which was the first fully developed paper constitution. So, yes, they have a sort of constitutional monarch,
right,
in a way. And the country's divided into military districts, basically. Each ruled by an army major general
right.
who answered only to Cromwell. So it's a proper dictatorship
yes.
at this point, with the sort of local administration being dished out to major generals. It's a military dictatorship. With godly governors. So it's these 15 major generals and deputy major generals. And they were central not only to national security, but also to the moral crusade that was going
great.
On. Now, local justices of the peace in these districts weren't too pleased about this because some of these men, they were army men, a lot of them. So although they were godly, they were seen as being lowborn.
Oh, no.
You know, so some of them were things like there was one guy who was a thimble maker. And they say you can't have a thimble maker making decisions.
Thimble makers.
John.
What have they ever done?
Can't have that. Right. What have the thimble makers ever done for
yes.
us? So it's Cromwell's law across the land is being implemented and enforced by the use of soldiers. Now, following on from the successes of the campaigns in Ireland and in Scotland, Cromwell now wants to take on the Spanish, right? Because he's pesky Catholics.
Well, they are the Antichrist.
He's sorting them out.
They are the Antichrist. So, you know.
They are the Antichrist. Now, the Spanish by this point have colonised a lot of South America, Caribbean islands around that sort of area. So as part of his campaign, and we haven't got time to go into the like full military sort of strategy he had, but they tried to take Hispaniola, which I believe is now, is it like part of Haiti?
Hispaniola is the island of the Dominican Republic and Haiti,
So, but they were defeated. They were defeated there because their soldiers weren't prepared, A, for the climate, for the journey, for lots of...
The voodoo.
And the Spanish... that were already there, were already acclimatized and were able to defeat him. So this whole worldview that Cromwell has of being, you know, of God's providence and them doing the work is suddenly challenged. They've gone, well, God's not let us win this one. We've been defeated.
So does he go, maybe I need to do this Puritan thing a bit less then?
Well, John, that's what you'd think, isn't it? Maybe I'm not, but no, he really doubles down.
Right.
Like he doubles down like Priti Patel. He digs his heels in. That's when all the theatres are closed down, sporting activities
are banned.
Don't
talk to me about theatres closed down. I was supposed to have
I'm sorry, did I open a wound there,
I was going to have a show in New York. I was going to have a show in London. It's all closed down for me. It's the plague. It's the plague has closed the theatres. So I do
but
continue.
But we'll have the post-COVID restoration comedies, John, and you'll be leading the vanguard.
at least we've got sporting activities at the moment. We can watch the football.
Exactly.
But no, he didn't have that either, did he? No sport?
No. Horse riding was definitely, because the Cavaliers obviously loved a bit of horseback entertainment.
No horse riding. And, I mean, I suppose they meant for pleasure. No horse riding, like gambling.
For pleasure,
on horses.
So no gambling, no drinking, no smoking.
No smoking?
Sex was sinful. Yeah, no smoking. Sex was sinful if you enjoyed it. Which probably wasn't too much of a worry if you were Cromwell's wife or the wife of any Puritan.
Actually, we should add that he was not a looker, Cromwell, was he? He's had a nose like a potato.
Yeah.
Remember when his portrait painter sat him down, he said, paint me as I am, warts and all.
Warts and all.
Yeah, because he had all warts all over his potato-like nose. So Mrs. Cromwell, you're forgiven.
Lucky lady.
Lucky lady sex.
She must have loved it when he was off in Ireland for ages. Like, what a relief.
She had played a bit of football and did some gambling and smoking.
If you were caught playing football on a Sunday, John, you could be whipped as punishment.
God.
Now, this is where I'd be in trouble, because swearing was punished by a fine.
You'd be bankrupt.
I'd be right in the fucking prison.
There you go again. So Christmas ban goes right back though, doesn't it?
The ban on Christmas, which is what people, I think, mostly think about when they think of this Cromwell's protectorate, actually goes back further. It goes back to
the beginning
right in the middle
war.
Of the Civil War.
Yeah.
It was still widely practiced, but you weren't allowed to call it Christmas. It was called Christtide to take away the
I
Catholic
bet you
mass
Cromwell
element.
Just forgot to get his wife a present. And he's like, she goes, did you get me something? Oh, it is an ungodly Antichrist festival of popery and paper. I don't know why he's come from Northern Ireland. I think we've...
he definitely didn't get... Well, he might have been an Ulster Scot.
It's because of Ian Paisley, that's what it is. But anyway, she's going, oh, well, I've got you a scented candle, you know, and it's like...
So he put her in the stock.
Yeah, whipped her and said you can't play football. I mean, it wasn't just that. Women weren't caught doing work on the holy day, could be put in the stocks, couldn't they? Or going for a walk on Sunday.
Unless you were going to church.
So I'd just go the long way, wouldn't you? I'd just go there, put my walking boots and go, I'm going to church. It's just, I'm just going up this lovely hill with this lovely view and then down the other side and then to church. How'd he not be able to go for a walk? That seems a bit over the top, doesn't it?
Well, right now it doesn't, John, no.
No, I mean, that's all I'm doing. That's my only exercise, walking the dog
true.
Every morning.
Yeah.
But they weren't allowed to put on makeup, women, were they?
No. And they really wanted to keep the population's mind on religion. So whereas previously with the Anglican Church and before that with the Catholic Church, you would have feast days to celebrate.
Right.
For the Puritans, they turned those days into fast days.
Oh, great.
So in order to keep your mind on the religion instead of the feast, you would, on your saint's day and so on, you'd have a fast instead. You wouldn't eat all day.
with a makeup ban, the Puritan leaders and soldiers sort of went round the streets looking for women and make them scrub off. It's a bit like Afghanistan, isn't it, really?
Yeah, the Taliban, yeah.
Yeah, colourful dresses. That's what I'm saying, you see. Colourful dresses banned. So the Puritan lady had to wear a long black dress that covered her almost. This is a Handmaid's Tale, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Long white apron. And also her hair's bunched
up. The men wore black as well, of course. And there's slight irony in that because it was supposed to show a sort of lack of frivolity and sort of humbleness. But actually, to produce black clothes was much more expensive.
Was it?
Because to produce black as a colour was really expensive. So actually their clothes were quite expensive.
So they were quite decadent, in fact, you're saying.
They were quite decadent, yeah.
Well, I do think I think the Puritan sort of strain has survived in the Protestant English. My dad would always say to my mum, "Oh, bloody Puritan English." And like he was always like, "Why are we going camping? You know, why aren't we just going to the most expensive hotel? Why are we beating ourselves up about all these things and making ourselves try and lose weight and making ourselves try and give up things for Lent?" He was always like, "Let's have fun. You know, let's drink a lot. Let's gamble."
And I think that's also not just a Puritan thing. I mean, the hair shirt thing and is also quite a Catholic thing, isn't
it? My dad was always very sort of like, drink, gamble.
Your dad just hated the English, John, and was just looking for any reason to compound that. Let's be honest.
But there is this sort of austere thing in sort of some of the English, isn't there? The sort of
No, there is. I mean, Cromwell, and it's also worth saying, much like many leaders, didn't, you know, like your Kim Jong-uns and your other dictators, didn't necessarily practice what he preached, John.
Oh no,
you know, because
I'm disappointed. I had such high opinion of him till now.
He was responsible for the morality of the masses.
Okay.
But his own, you know, he was Cromwell. He was a child of God. So it's fine. He could drink and smoke and, you know, listen to music.
There was one rule for the rich and another one for the poor. Where have we seen that before?
Apparently, he even had a bit of erotic art in Hampton Court.
Oh, that's art, Angela. That's different.
That's art. Like my, yeah. Now, there's one of the things you read quite a lot about when you read about Oliver Cromwell seems so insane in light of what we've just been discussing, but that he was a sort of promoter of religious tolerance and liberty of conscience. And
unless you're a Catholic.
Unless you're a Catholic or a Quaker.
Okay.
And I think what that meant is, obviously, again, it's hard for us to imagine at a time when Protestantism is so in the blood of the people, you know, it's such a everybody is under that church. You know, there's a state church under Cromwell, but you weren't required to attend it. You could, Catholics included, worship privately.
Oh, really? Okay.
You could, but so you didn't have to be a member anymore of the state church, for example, to be to go to university.
Okay.
Or to join the professions, which before Cromwell and indeed after Cromwell, you did have to be a member of the state church.
I think he just doesn't know what he's on about. I think he's just he's just all over the place.
It's almost like, John, he got thrown into a position without really. There's one thing I read sort of compared it to Brexit a little bit, that the kind of trial and, you know, we want the king gone, we want this done, you know, get the king's death done.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, a bit of sort of, well, now what?
Right, okay. You know? And then he was very tolerant of the Jews as well, wasn't he?
He was. In fact, I mean, the Jews had been banished by Edward I, I think it was.
That's going back a bit.
Going back 350 years from this point. And it was Cromwell who welcomed them back. There's lots of theories as to why he did that. Some say it's because of his religious tolerance. Others say it's because, and we talked about this in our Tulip episode.
Yes.
We're approaching that golden age, you know, where the Dutch were sort of nailing it economically. And the Jewish communities in Holland were seen to play a big part in that. And he had seen what was going on in Holland. He'd been to Holland. And so it was thought that that's part of the reason that he invited the Jews to resettle in England, was because he saw the economic benefits of doing
that. I think that's too sensible for a reason for a madman like him. I think, A, he liked a bagel.
Right.
Spokes, you know, cream cheese and lox, lovely. But I actually think, I think what I read was that he was such an Old Testament man that he sort of empathised with the Jews and Moses and the flight from where did they come from again? Israel, that's right.
And, Israel, yeah.
And he was sort of really into the Jewish sort of book of the Bible, and he welcomed them back for that reason. That seems more likely than he was thoughtful about the sort of the economy. I think he did anything for a sort of economic reasons. It was all faith.
The Quakers really suffered during the Protectorate. George Fox, who was the kind of instigator of the Quaker movement in England, was imprisoned. Although it was said that Cromwell and him did meet several times and actually had quite a good rapport.
Okay.
But the idea of Quakerism, because Quakerism is the idea, isn't it, that you can have a relationship with God without needing a church.
Yeah, right, okay.
That was verging on atheism as far as your Puritans were concerned.
You don't want to pick a fight with a Quaker, though. Once you get them in a pub car park, they'll turn the other cheek and forgive you.
Oh, God.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
So basically, he was trying to build this godly commonwealth and rode roughshod over anyone who got in his way.
Yes.
He would raise taxation without consent, which is what he'd got, you know, they got pissed off with Charles I
yes.
doing.
Yeah, and he was doing much more. He was doing all the things that Charles did, all the things that Charles I had done that yeah. offended people. Cromwell was doing it more.
Because he's, you know, starting to abuse his powers, again, Parliament are worrying about this. They can see that this man is
out of control.
Religious megalomania in this yeah. man. So what they do at this point is they offer him, John, the throne.
Okay.
Because by being king, it would actually hand quite a lot of power back to Parliament.
Right. So because there's precedent. Because they'd had precedent.
Because there's precedent. Yeah. yeah. Cromwell thought about this.
Yep.
And he sort of ummed and ahed about it because, like I said before, he wasn't totally anti-monarchy. He wanted to replace Charles I by even by one of his sons.
Right.
When after the regicide. At that point, he discussed restoration of the House of Stuart at the beginning of the Protectorate because he wasn't anti-monarchy. He was anti that monarch.
Yeah.
But he had essentially challenged the divine right of kings. He's overthrown the monarchy. Is it right for him then to establish another one? Even though essentially he had, or something worse than a monarchy, a dictatorship.
Yes.
So he agonised over it for sort of 6 weeks, attracted by the prospect of stability, but he held out. And in a speech on the 13th of April, 1657, he made it clear that God's providence had spoken against the office of king. He said, "I would not seek to set up that which providence hath destroyed and laid in the dust, and I would not build Jericho again."
We're not talking about Jericho, the nice middle class bit of Oxford, are we?
No.
Where Philip Pullman lives.
No, we're not, no.
I think that's amazing that, that he took 6 weeks to decide that wasn't for him.
Yeah.
I mean, the day that Charles I had been executed, Cromwell had slept in Charles's bed, which I think is always a bit of a clue that he's like, oh, this is comfy. This is nice. I'm liking this. But they must have found him, if he's not going to be king, they must have found him another title. Lord of Sealand?
Yeah, that's right, John. he was already Lord Protector. He'd been made Lord right. Protector with the okay. instrument of government and the constitution in 1653. But in 1657, they sort of ceremonially reinstalled him as Lord Protector. They did it with him sitting on King Edward's chair, which was moved from right. Westminster Abbey. There was a purple ermine-lined robe and a sword of justice and an ermine-lined coronet. But it wasn't a coronation, John.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Definitely wasn't. He wasn't king, John.
No, he wasn't. Just because he had an ermine-lined coronet. We've all got those.
Yeah.
Who hasn't got a purple lined robe.
Exactly. So at this point, he's sort of got the mantle of royalty. His council is made up of yes men. Basically, it's made up of his family. It's a bit Trumpian. Sort of advisors are all his family. At this point, there were assassination attempts. There were fears for his life.
Right.
Because people weren't happy.
Yeah, yeah.
What they hadn't really sorted out, when they made him Lord Protector back in 1953, they hadn't really sorted out what would happen when he died.
No. Because if he'd been king, it would have gone to his son, wouldn't it?
It would have gone to his son if he'd been king.
Yeah.
And that essentially is what happened. Now, he had several children, Oliver Cromwell, but his oldest son was a son called Richard. He also had a son called Henry, who was younger. Now, Henry was a commander in Ireland. After the conquest, right. he was sort of installed there to keep an eye on Ireland. And by all accounts, was a much better statesman and, you know, would have been the worthy person to take over.
Yep, youngest brothers often
are John, ones. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Because he had an older brother, and they sort of wanted to appease those in Parliament who did still have royalist leanings by sort of following a pattern of royal descent.
Wow.
So they died of complications with malaria.
Right.
And there was a cure for malaria, or certainly something that would have helped him. But it was a cure that was developed by Jesuits in the Caribbean. And so he refused to take it because Jesuits, because of the name.
He was an anti-vaxxer. He was an anti-vaxxer. He was like, that's Bill Gates, that is. They're going to put a little chip in my blood, those Jesuits. It's the same fucking stupid thing as now, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it killed him. Exactly. And it killed him because he was so prejudiced against Catholics. He wouldn't have something with Jesuit on the label. They could have just called it something else. They could have called it Jesus powder.
Yeah,
and he would
Jesus
have been
powder
fine
or just anti-malarial powder, anything. But
that's a good name. That's a good name. You've been working on this for a while,
there
Angela.
You go.
Thanks for joining our campaign team. Well, good riddance to him, I say.
Yep. So Richard Cromwell, his oldest son, was nominated and installed as Lord Protector, but he just wasn't very good at it and didn't really care about it.
He just didn't want his dad's job, did he? No. Like, you've got to have the family business.
Yeah.
The running a mad Puritan.
I want to be an
mad
actor.
Puritan dictator. I want to go to drama school.
Yeah.
He was called Tumbledown Dick, wasn't he?
He was known as Tumbledown Dick, which is not a good name.
It lasted about a year or so.
Not even that. I think it was like September to May or something.
Right.
And he fell from power pretty swiftly. In the meantime, you had George Monk, who was a commander up in Scotland.
Yeah.
He'd been sort of watching the situation unfold and kind of waiting to see what might happen next.
Yeah.
He is essentially, when Richard took over, saw that it wasn't working out, marched south with his army and essentially restored the monarchy.
So, given that, you could put quite a contrarian argument to say that the royalists won the English Civil Wars because the final outcome was that with a big army,
a king was put
back on the throne.
Yeah, in 1660.
Charles II. Yeah, so we had the Restoration, we had theatres back open, we had all those Restoration comedies, which were actually funny, unlike Shakespeare's comedies. You have, dancing, smoking, women wearing makeup, that's the most important thing.
Yeah. And people's lives have a bit of joy in them again.
Yeah, and then they say, so all that stuff about God condemning us, don't believe any of that stuff. Just carry on. What's that? The Great Plague? What's that? London burnt down? Oh.
That's
nothing to do with us. Nothing to do with us.
But when Sir Charles II rode into London, it was on his 30th birthday, and the crowds in the street were so that it took the procession 7 hours to pass through the city.
Well, that's London traffic, Angela.
Well,
that's completely normal.
That's just every day.
If you'd been on a bicycle, you would have been all right.
And the roads were strewn with flowers, church bells rang out, and it was... And Charles felt that Providence, that divine right of things, had brought him back to where he should be.
And he actually ruled with exactly the same contempt for Parliament as his dad.
Yes.
But there was a crucial difference. I've sort of read between the lines when I was reading all the books about this. But whereas Charles ignored Parliament, Charles I, and tore up the bills in their faces, which greatly offended them, when parliamentarians marched to the palace to confront Charles II, he said, come down the wine cellar. Come and taste my sherries. I've got these ports from the Iberian Peninsula. I've got these delicious sherries. They all got drunk and forgot about what they were mad about. So he had exactly the same result, but he was just more charming.
Yeah.
And so that's why, it wasn't until his brother was on the throne that they had to do it all over again and get rid of the Catholics and restore the power of Parliament. But Charles II just got by just sleeping with lots of women and having lots of fun. And chasing a moth around his bedroom with his mistress when the Dutch were invading the River Medway.
Because I think a lot of people sort of see this as the path, or the interregnum as the path to the constitutional monarchy. But really, that, because there was a big setback in Charles II with that. And I think that didn't really happen until the Glorious Revolution, right?
Yeah, till James II.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing about it that I think is interesting is that any idea that the British are sort of more civilized than the Germans, and that we would never have had the Holocaust, or we would never have, the massacres of Rwanda. Every nationality or race is capable of enormous inhumanity, and Cromwell's soldiers demonstrated that in Ireland. And no country is above, the most baseless sort of inhumanity of which we are capable. That's the lesson I take away from this 10-year dictatorship.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that religion is nuts.
Yeah, completely nuts. Sorry, no offense. You heard it here, guys.
Yeah. But, you know, to be so certain of something that it justifies everything else is the road to Auschwitz, to Drogheda, to, you know, all the great sort of massacres of history.
Absolutely.
People making other humans inhuman and believing they're justified in their actions by God.
Yeah.
So that's my top tip, listeners. don't make other people subhumans.
Thank you,
even on Twitter.
Well, that's it then. We've had a little trot through the British Republic.
I wonder if, Angela, next week we might have a break from the bloody school curriculums.
Yeah.
For 3 weeks, we assisted you with your homeschooling.
I hope it's going all right.
You're on your own again. Sorry.
For a bit. We'll see. Don't forget to give us a tweet on @WeAreHistoryPod if you want to chat to us.
Give us a
5-star review if you would be so kind. Very much.
Because we give you 5 stars back as a listener.
We
so
do.
You've got
your
own rating, you know. So
you can't see it, but it's definitely there.
Yeah.
That's it for
Thanks
today. We'll see you next
everyone.
Week. Cheers.
Bye.